Thanks for inviting me to speak. So today I want to discuss some work I did last year about Brazilian stability conditions and the context in which that appeared and some more recent things I've been thinking about. So let's see. How many people in the audience are familiar with the Brazilian stability condition, or should I review them? I should review them. Yeah. So Brazilian stability condition, I'm not going to spend too much time. So zero stability conditions. So this is a notion of stability that was defined by Bridgeland on triangulated categories, inspired by work on physics about brains. I'm not going to talk about any of the physics in this talk. It's going to be purely about trying to construct these things. But the inspiration does come from physics. So is a kind of structure, even though it's called a condition, it's really a kind of structure that you have on triangulated categories. So let's see. D is my triangulated category. Triangulated K-linear category for some field K. So I'm going to fix a field K throughout the talk. What's a Brazilian stability condition? It's a set of data. So stability condition. I'm going to not say Brazilian anymore for the rest of this talk, just to be concise. Sigma is a pair Z and P. And what are the Z's and P's? So Z is a C-linear map from the growth and degroup of my category to complex numbers. So this map is usually called the central charge. So if you're thinking about in terms of the physics inspired, this would be correspond to integrating some form over your brain, if you're talking about categories of brains. And P, so P is called a slicing. So slicing. So it's a collection of subcategories, P phi, for real phases. So phi is I'm going to refer to it as the phase. So the collection of subcategories, let's say the full, so each p phi is a full additive subcategory. It's going to end up being abelian, but and they satisfy some sort of compatibility. So the compatibility they satisfy is first that p, the slicing p, behaves well with the shift. So p at phase 5 plus 1 is the same thing as p phi shifted by 1, right? So basically, if you know for phi in an interval, you know for all of them. Second condition, that if you have an object in p phi and another object in p psi with phi bigger than psi, then Hom in this category between x and y is 0, right? So this is going to be a very important feature for us. So remember, mnemonic is no Homs to lower phase, right? And in the next condition you want for this, so right now I didn't talk about the central charge at all. This is just conditions on this slicing p. The third condition on the slicing p is
the degree zero part.
Yeah, if I don't put anything, it's going to be degree zero. If I put like an asterisk, is the whole thing. Right. So. Another property. There, one, if you have any non-zero object in D, then this object X has some decomposition in terms of objects in these subcategories. So some finite number big N, and this is X, and so you know it's some triangulated category, so it doesn't really make sense to talk. They're not injective maps, so it doesn't make sense to say that, but they have they all fit inside of distinguished triangles. Right, where AI is in this P phi I, and the phi I's are decreasing. Right, so it has this filtration. I'm going to call this the Harder-Narasimham filtration. And terminology is that the objects in here are going to be called semi-stable of phase phi. Okay. So, of course, if you're familiar with notion of stability in algebraic geometry, this is going to ring all sorts of bells, and in fact, it looks a lot like what you get from slope stability on bundles, right? So just to example of a stability condition here is if you have X is some smooth. Can you read down here, or should I go to the next one? It's fine? OK. I just kind of have to write. If you have a smooth projective curve, and you look at the category, which is the bounded derived category of X, then for any vector bundle E, so vector bundle E on X, you can find a filtration just like that, right? So 0 in 1 E, such that these quotients are stable bundles. Stable bundles, semi-stable. So what semi-stable means? Semi-stable bundle and a vector bundle E is semi-stable if for any sub-bundle, you have the slope of E prime is less or equal to the slope of E, right? Where slope is, I'm going to call slope is mu, but slope is degree over rank, right? Anyways, so you can extend, you know, this doesn't make any sense for torsion sheaves because the rank is zero there, but you can extend it to that by putting the phase to be infinity, and slope stability, which is this, does give me a notion of Brisbane stability on the categorical coherent sheaves, right? Okay, so in this paper that Brisbane defined this, he also proves a really interesting theorem. That if you take the space of stability conditions on D, so this is for now it's still a set of stability conditions in D, and you forget P. So you just remember the Hom from into C. I lied a little bit here actually. I want my stability, my central charge to factor through a finite lattice. So in a later example, this is not going to matter because they're always going to have a finite rank Grothendieck deep group. But yeah, you really want a finite lattice over here. So there's some finite rank lattice. Right. So theorem is that this is a local homeomorphism, like local isomorphism of complex manifolds. Right. So this thing is imbued with is given the structure of complex manifold, and you have this local homeomorphism. Moreover, you also have actions of groups on here. So you have an action of automorphisms of the category D, which is just by composing everything with the automorphism. And you also have an action of GL2R, but only the part with positive determinant, and actually not really an action of this, but an action of the universal cover of this thing. Okay, and then at the end of this paper, Bijan, he gives one detailed calculation, which is the case where my category D is coherent sheet, bounded derived category, coherent sheaves on some elliptic curve, right? So in that case, this lattice lambda they use for like a finite dimensional replacement for the Grothendieck group is this numerical Grothendieck group of D, which we can it's K naught of D modulo the kernel of Euler form, but it doesn't matter too much to us. Just let's just say this is just Z plus Z, where one of the Z's is the rank, and the other one is the degree, right? Okay, so in this example, Ridgeland proves, so there's a theorem, another theorem of Ridgeland, that this action is free and transitive, so stability space of D is the same thing as this isomorphic as GL2 plus R tilde. So this is saying basically, so what is this doing? This is just acting on the complex plane, right? So you have all your objects have this central charge, and you're just acting with GL2 plus R, and you're rotating those central charges and doing something appropriate thing to the slicing. But all the orbits, all the stability conditions on the orbit of this action, on one particular orbit of this action, are basically the same. They have the same collection of semi-stable objects, et cetera. They just have different phases. sorry, I've been a little sick this week. So why is this true? In this case, this results saying that this space is not really that interesting. There's basically one stability condition up to rotation by the GL rotation and scaling. And the reason is because the elliptic curve is Calabi-Yau 1. So basically the proof is the elliptic curve is 1 Calabi-Yau. And so what does that mean? I mean that for any x and y in this category D, or D, in the category D, Hom from, let's say Hom, and now I'm going to look at all degrees, x to y, is minus 1. Right, so you have this is third duality composed with the fact that the third functor here is just shift by 1 because it's Calabi-Yau 1. Right? Okay, so why? What does this have to do with us? So I'll just rewrite this. If I want the degree 0 part, I just have Hom x to y, and this is x to 1 from y to x dual. So I'm just looking at the degree 0 part here. And remember that we, in a definition of stability condition, we said every object has its decomposition into these objects, into these a bunch of semi-stable objects, right? So this cannot happen here because if suppose you take some object X that's indecomposable, right? So if that's indecomposable, I suppose I had some non-trivial filtration like this, right? So at some point you're gonna have, for example, if it's like a, it could be an extension of an object A1 by an object A2. Sorry, extension of A2 by A1. But see here, A1 and A2 being in this order means that the phase of A1 is bigger than the phase of A2. So this means that so if X has a decomposition, this Hardanger Simha decomposition, it means that the phase of A2 1 is bigger than the phase of A2, right? But then that's a problem because, you know, that if it's a non-trivial extension, then this map of degree 1 is X lives in X1. So there's a Hom in the other direction going this way, right? Which is not, which also goes against our assumption for the slicing, right? Because you want no Homs to lower phase. So the Calabria 1 condition really puts you, makes your set of stability conditions very limited, right? And okay, so this case is very boring, right? Because every indecomposable object is going to be semi-stable. So basically, this means it's a semi-stable. Okay. So I want to look at a case where I have a similar phenomenon that simplifies the situation, but not so much to make it completely trivial, like the coherent sheaves on the elliptic curve. And the reason why I want to do that is it's going to become later clear that this sort of Calabria 1 condition allows you to perform some sort of cutting and gluing procedure that you couldn't do otherwise. So the next class of examples I want to work with is so section 2. I guess section 1. So I'm going to talk about topological Foucaire categories of surfaces. So this is going to be the class of examples that I'm going to be working within. Right? So what kind of surface are we talking about? A topological surface, and so I'm going to define. So define a graded a marked surface. So it's a marked surface. So denote sigma m and eta. So sigma is some topological surface with boundary. I mean, I want it to have boundary, with boundary sigma non-empty. M is a union of intervals inside of the boundary of sigma, and eta is a line field on sigma. And I don't want to spend too much time talking about the line field, but I'll make a couple drawings to explain. So the marked surface, what it looks like, it, for example, I'm going to draw a surface with, let me just make a drawing first. Okay.
So by dashed line, the boundary is going to have sort of dashed and solid lines. And dashed, solid is marked, and dashed is unmarked. Okay, so this is a marked surface. It has some boundary and some collection of intervals. And I'm going to, for now on, assume that at least every boundary component has at least one marked interval, just to make things simpler. Okay, so this line field, I'll just say a couple words about it, is a, so eta is a section on my surface sigma of the projectivized tangent bundle of sigma. Right? So just a choice of like a line at every point, a smooth choice of line at every point, defines some sort of foliation of the surface. And you know, there's some way in which it has to interact with the marked components. I don't want to go there. But so it has this line field. So what this structure buys us, this line field structure buys us, is that you can assign degrees to intersection of curves inside of your surface, right? So we're going to be looking at curves on the surface. Right, so let's say you have two curves like this intersecting at some point, right? I want to define also a define the marked surface. You can also define a graded curve. So this line field is also called a grading. So a graded curve is just an some inverse curve in sigma. So. But moreover, I'm not going to have only the inverse curve. I'm also going to have some relation between its tangent vectors and this foliation. So suppose you like zoom into part of the surface, and this is the line field that you're seeing, right? And you have this curve sitting here. So to make it a graded curve, I'm going to choose it comes down to choosing a particular generator for some homotopy group type thing. But basically, how I'm going to think about it is I'm going to choose how many times I'm going from the horizontal foliation, sorry, the line field foliation eta, to the tangent at some point, right? So there is a, so let's call this gamma.
Sorry. Yeah.
It's representing that for this curve, I chose to grade it, saying that I only go like 90 degrees in this case from the line field to the curve, right?
So you're saying that a priori the green line and the white line intersect we have an angle just defined mod pi. Lifting that to
You're lifting it to number. Yeah, exactly. You're lifting to the real numbers, yeah, and. But like up to homotopy, because you know they can. Later, I'm going to want to move this curve around, and there's an operator shift on the node shift by one, just because it's going to be shift by one in the category I'm going to have eventually. But what this operator does, it just sort of adds pi to that. So it's not literally mod 2 pi. This you have to think about this orientation somehow. Anyways, so as you see, this is kind of like some flabby information because as you move the curve around, this changes. But what it gives me is that if I have two curves intersecting at a point, right? And I picked beforehand, let's say, this set of data. Let me say I'm going to go down now. At this point, you can count how many times
you're, I don't know how to say this, how many times you,
It's a relative angle,
and you see if you just move this curve around and change its angle, the sort of relative one doesn't change. So this defines an integer, which is a degree of intersection between any two curves. So the point is P, and this curve like alpha and beta. This defines, for an intersection, defines me a number IP alpha beta, and another integer IP beta alpha. So these are both in Z. And if you think a little bit about the relation, they add to one. How to define this? This number, you see, it was your puzzled face. You first start from one of them. You go back to the. You start from the line field. You go to one of them. Then you go the minimum angle necessary in like some direction, and then you go back to the line field using the other one.
What about IP alpha alpha?
Sorry.
IP alpha alpha.
That's not defined. Yeah.
I mean, there's some sort of transverse.
Yeah, there's some. You can say that's zero. Yeah.
But because if it was a non-transverse intersection, then
it doesn't really matter if it's non-transverse either. Yeah.
You have to make some convention.
You don't need to. The convention is you just go like counterclockwise and minimum angle to go from one to the other.
Like if it's a bad intersection, there's still a lot of.
Yeah, you can just move. Yeah.
Something for each point of intersection.
Yeah, it's defined for. It depends on P, right? But you see that, I already told you that I want to understand these as objects of something, and of course intersections are going to be morphisms, and this is where this Calabi-Yau one condition is sort of appearing, right?
But at the end of the day, you're going to tell me that the Hom space between two curves is
hopefully not at the end of the day, but in the next 5 minutes. So I'm going to define this category now. And the sort of idea that this category has been around for a while, but the definition I'm going to use here is due to Haydn, Kotsakov, and Kuntsevich. Right? So they, let's see, how much time do I have? I think I'm going to sort of skip the definition of this category, just give the result. Basically, it says that there is some triangulated category F of sigma. So this is Fukaya category of sigma. And whose indecomposable objects, so in the composable objects are in bijection with immersed curves with local system, with indecomposable local system. And actually, yeah. So what kind of curves are we looking at here? So these immersed curves, they can be of two types. They can either be circles, right? So circles immersed into there. Or they can be intervals, except that for an interval, I'm going to require that the ends of the interval are on this. I'm messing up my color coding here. They can either be circles or they can be intervals, but the ends of the interval are going to have to end on this marked boundary of the surface, right? So the curves I'm looking at, can be here, or they can go from marked boundary to marked boundary. And the intersection and the morphisms
As you imagine, you know, come from intersection like that. So come from intersection in the interior. And also, plus, if they share a marked boundary component, so for example, this is alpha and beta, this is alpha and beta, the morphisms come from points of intersection and also from boundary paths. So boundary path is something that goes along the marked component, keeping the surface sigma to the right. So, and the same way, there's a way of giving a degree to this intersection. There's also giving a way of giving a degree to this boundary path. But note here that there's a, we call this like M for this marked boundary component. The P gives you something in Hom from alpha to beta in degree, let's say D. And it also gives you something in Hom 1 minus D from beta to alpha, right? Meanwhile, here the boundary path M only gives you Hom in some degree D from alpha to beta, because you made this requirement that the path can only go in one direction, right? So if you are comfortable with Foucault categories, this is you know, some description of the partially wrapped Foucault category. So the reason why you have this like one directionality is that you computing Hom from one object to another, you wrap one of them in one direction. And in that context, the unmarked boundary are the stops of my manifold. But actual geometry aside, you can define this combinatorially. And so here we see this fact that if you have a Hom in degree d, you also have a Hom in degree 1 minus d going in the opposite direction, right? So this allows us to prove a couple of interesting lemmas about these categories and stability conditions. So I'm going to give you two lemmas now that are going to be very important, and those are the ones that we're going to try to do in other contexts later. So lemma one is that you take any stability condition on this category. And by the way, these three people, they start studying this category because they want to construct stability conditions on them. So they construct some class of stability conditions, but let's not go into that. Suppose you have some generic stability condition, you don't know anything about it. And you have X is some rank 1 indecomposable object of F of sigma, right? So every object, every indecomposable object is some immersed curve. I just say pick some immersed curve with the rank 1 local system on it, because then you're allowed to put higher rank local systems too.
How did you determine the degree of the morphism again?
This one? Here?
Yeah.
Because I chose gradients for these curves originally, right, which were these like red arrows. And at a particular point, the like angle for the curve is not really defined because you can move the curve around. But if you have two things that intersect, then the relative angle is going to be well defined.
So the D there is the IP.
The D here is the IP alpha beta.
Cool, cool.
Yeah, but just it's D is going to be 1 minus D. Anyway, the lemma is if you have some indecomposable object of this, then under the stability condition, then either X is a stable circle, so it's a circle, is represented by some embedded circle inside, and it's stable, so it's stable under the stability condition, or X decomposes into a chain of objects. the chain of intervals. So what do I mean by that is if you have any object, let's say x, so the blackboard is the surface, and these are some marked boundary components, and you have an object x here. And now I use this stability condition to decompose, and it's some black box. It decomposes this object into stable pieces. And then I look again, I see which stable pieces I have. You can always find representatives such that the stable pieces look like a chain of intervals, like this. Right? So objects sort of decompose the chain, which is what you would expect under this expectation that they have to, has to do with the mean, like Lagrangian flow. So this lemma one. So I'm gonna call this lemma chain lemma. Right. And lemma two. And so this is only. So let me just say a bit about the proof of this. It's actually very simple. So you know all these objects in this head in the category have the description, and the morphisms are either points intersection in the middle or shared boundary, right? These you can never use to extend objects in this like harder Narasimhan filtration because of this Calabi-Yau 1 condition, right? If you have an extension from alpha to beta, then you have a Hom going from beta to alpha, and you don't want that. So you can only use things extension at the ends. And then that means that the only possibility is a chain. The actual argument's a little more involved, but.
Sorry, what was the definition of rank?
What is it?
What's the definition of rank?
Rank? Oh, I'm allowed to put local systems on this thing.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just that if it's higher rank, then like some other weird stuff can happen. Yeah.
It's the rank
of the local. So lemma two is that if you have in your surface, you have objects x and y, objects with disjoint representatives. So, in your surface, x and y are like this. Then the chains that you get from doing this, never cross. Right? So they might touch one another. So you might get a situation when, for example, an object, I'm just repeating the, that's not the clutter. So x was here and y was here, where, for example, they share some they share some interval, right? So in this case, x got decomposed into this piece, and y got decomposed into this piece, right? So they might their chains might overlap at points. So this is okay. What you don't get is a situation where you have a chain for x goes like this, and then a chain for y sort of cuts it and then cuts back. Right? You don't get that. And this comes from thinking about the intersections and their phases. So I'm going to call this thing the non-crossing lemma. Okay. Oh yeah. Another way of phrasing, not really another way, but a corollary of lemma one is that if I start, lemma one doesn't make any assumption about the shape of x. It can be a circle. You can decompose it to like a chain of intervals that closes up. But if x, can I write here? Is it too far? It's kind of far.
It's fine.
Yeah. Actually, I'll just sneak the corollary in here. So corollary of lemma one is if x is an interval then if I take, I'm going to call this env sigma of x. So this is going to be the envelope of x under sigma. But what I mean by that, this is the category generated by all the stable, semi-stable pieces of x. Semi-stable pieces of x under sigma. Then this thing is the category, for example, generated by all of these pieces in this picture. And if you think about what the category looks like, is you know, we get some object here, there's an extension to the next object, next simple object, extension to the next simple object. So this category is always isomorphic to represent derived category of representations of some A in quiver. So in this case, it's going to be a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 quiver. So this category is very nice. You have the geometricity statement that tells you what the objects look like. And when you put stability condition on it, no matter, even though you might not know what the stability condition looks like, you know what the envelopes of some objects look like, right? So it's kind of very rare to find. All right. So why do I care about all of this? It's because this sort of thing allows me to cut a stability condition along something that separates my surface, right? Because you can kind of see from the non-crossing lemma that if you have two things that are separated, they're stability data shared, it's like at most shared, but it doesn't cross. It doesn't go into the other side. Okay, so sorry. I want to talk a little bit about the definition of a relative stability condition now for these categories. Very hard to erase this board. There's no board underneath this one, right? There's just TV. Yeah. Looks fine.
The way to lock the.
What is it?
The way to lock the board.
I don't know, it's fine. So before I introduce the definition, I just want to sort of motivate a little bit, right? So suppose you have a surface sigma, and you know, it has like genus, it can do whatever, you have more punctures, more boundary components, and another part of the surface here. And it has a, I'm gonna figure out my chalk on this side. And it has a interval that cuts the surface into two. I'm gonna call this interval gamma. Right. So suppose I start with that, and then I pick a stability condition on sigma. So I pick a stability condition on this Foucaille category of sigma, right? So under that, this gamma is going to decompose into something. Okay, so let's say gamma decomposes into some zigzag like this, right? So that's lemma one. And lemma two says that also if I have any other object, so like red object, in here or something. When I decompose this into its own chain, it's at most going to run into this chain the gamma decomposed into, but it's never going to run into the other side of the surface, right? So somehow the stability condition on the left side of the surface only runs to some
minimally extended part of the left side of the surface, which contains all these other chain. So this motivates my definition. So so now let's start with a sigma that has a has this lambda but sitting on this boundary. So sigma is, you know, in Foucault category language, some marked surface, and lambda is linking a stop on the boundary of this of the surface. I'm going to define the space of relative stability conditions on sigma relative to gamma to be, so I take a disjoint union, a huge disjoint union of stability conditions, spaces, not on sigma, but on some extended version of sigma. So I take sigma and along gamma, I glue a disk with n, but n plus 2 marked components, right? So for example, in n equals 3 k's here, this is my disk, 3 plus 2. Right, so it has 5 marked boundary components, and I'm gluing along gamma, so along, I'm extending the surface, right? So if you should think about this picture, this sort of extended surface is exactly what happens when you look at one side of the surface plus everything that appeared in the decomposition of that interval, right? So I take this big union of stability spaces. And of course, there's some like disconnected space, but I don't want that because I want to be able to sort of smoothly move from one stability condition to another. So there is some equivalence relation, which I'm not going to get into because of time. They divide by. So just in a few words, a relative stability condition on sigma is a stability condition on this extended surface, which I'm going to call usually not sigma tilde or something. Okay. So so this space, lemma, the space is Hausdorff. This is Hausdorff. Even though it's quite nasty, but it's infinite dimensional. But it's okay because it's also filtered. Sort of by definition, I can take everything up to some level n. So it's filtered by these finite dimensional singular spaces. And turns out this sort of naive idea that you had that you could cut the surface, the stability condition to one side and into the other, it actually works. So theorem, there are cutting and gluing maps. Just maps cut and glue. So what do they do? So cut takes a stability condition on the category for the whole sigma. And maps it to a subset of the product of relative stability spaces. So sigma 1, sigma L, gamma cross Rels tab, sigma R, gamma. So this is a subset of compatible conditions. And there's also a gluing map that goes the other way. A gluing map. And their inverses.
So what we got out of this is that if you know how to decompose a surface in a particularly nice way, you can start with the stability condition you didn't understand, cut it down, get things on smaller pieces, and then hopefully understand the big stability condition. So in fact, that what you can do, so now let's say I start with some like random marked surface. I'm gonna move things around so that it always looks like this. This is a marked part of the boundary. It might have more markings on that boundary component. It has a bunch of like other punctures inside, etc. And it has a bunch of like genus attached to it, etc. Anyways, I just move my surface around so that it looks like this. And now I'm going to draw a bunch of separating intervals. So each one of these intervals cuts the surface into these pieces. They're either disks with a bunch of marked boundaries, or annuli, right? This one's an annulus with some marked boundaries inside and out, or the punctured toroid with markings on the boundary too, right? So whatever surface you start with, you decompose into these three types. And by doing an analysis of each one of the types separately, you can prove corollary. If sigma has at least one marked boundary on each S1 in the boundary of sigma, then every stability condition on F of sigma is of HKK type. So I didn't get to say what these were, but they're the ones constructed by Heiding, Hatzakovic, and Savage. So so this is, I thought when I figured this out, I thought it was quite exciting because it was the first time I had to that I was able to not start with the construction of a stability condition, but just with some generic one, and prove things about it. In general, if you don't know your category extremely well, it's really hard to prove things about the whole stability space. You at most can get components of it. Okay, so I think, can I go past the hour? Is that fine?
Yeah.
Yeah.
As long as you're not insulted, people run away.
Okay, yeah, fine. Feel free to leave.
Everyone, yeah. You're free.
Yeah. All right, so. Well, the category is pretty cool, but it's only one class of categories. And ideally, I'd like to know if I can extend this sort of thing to other contexts. And for that, what we're going to try to do now is sort of abstract away from the explicit description of this category, just from the like smallest facts that we need to make this construction work. Right. So remember that in order to start proving any of these things, we started with this lemma that said that every object decomposes into some chain of intervals. And to prove that, we use this Calabi-Yau 1 property, right? That the category sort of had morphisms in the interior and the boundary, and the ones in the interior were Calabi-Yau 1. They had sort of complementary morphisms in a different degree. So I want to formalize that. But before I formalize, let me just work out one example explicitly. So just to see what's happening. So example. is very simple. Take a disk with four marked boundaries. Okay. So the sigma, the Foucault category of this surface is isomorphic to representation category of the A3 quiver. Right? How do we see that? Well, I'm going to draw a couple objects here. So I'm going to draw this object and call S1, this object S2, S3, and maybe like this one is S4. So you see that each S1, S2, S3, and S4 is sort of an image of the inclusion of, well, it's like a, if you imagine you're getting the boundary by gluing in a sort of an interval like this, S1 is the image of this object into here, right? So I'm going to note X to be this category, the Foucault category of the whole thing. And I'm going to write down another category, Y, script Y. And this is basically the Foucault category of the boundary of sigma, right? So in our case, it's just four copies of, it's going to look silly, but representations of A1 quiver. There's four copies of that, one for each piece of the boundary. S1, S2, and S3 are images of functor from Y to X. So let me define some functors here down, and then I'm going to use them to assemble my bigger functors. So let's define functors PI. That go from. I'm gonna drop the bounded derived. It's always gonna be bounded derived. Rep A3 to the vector spaces, and QI rep A1 to rep A3. And I is going to go from 1, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, so I just labels which one I'm talking about. So I'm going to write them explicitly. So what are the P's? The P's go from rep of A3. So rep of A3 is some collection of three vector spaces with mass between them. Right, so this is some element in A3. And I'm going to say P1 takes this and spits out V1, so this first vector space. P2 spits out the fiber of F. P3 spits out the fiber of G. And P4 spits out V3. So these are the P maps. The Q maps start from rep of A1, so just some vector space V, and Q1 maps this to V0, 0, which is, I'm going to identify with this, with that S1. Q2 maps to 0, V0, S2, Q3, 0, 0, V, S3. And Q4, F2VVV, which I'm going to identify with S4. OK, so there's a bunch of maps. And you can, I'm going to assemble them into maps from X into some adjoint maps between X and Y. So I'm going to assemble all the P maps, first all the Q maps, into a functor. I'm going to call f star. So this is a functor from y to x. So the boundary to interior. And that is going to be this q1 plus q2 plus q3 plus q4. So basically, when I apply this functor to, let's say, v, it just puts v on each one of these objects, right? And I'm going to use the p functors, to make a functor I'm going to call f from x to y. And this is p2 plus p3 plus p4 plus p1. And you check by hand that f star is left adjoint to f. Right. So why am I doing this? It's because I want to formalize this notion that intersection is happening in the interior versus happening in the boundary. Right. So I can use this sort of so this basically is going to be some co-restriction from the boundary, and this is some restriction to the boundary. And I want to formalize the notion that if I make objects x and y here, and they intersect at a point P, then there's the morphism coming from P does not come from the boundary, right? And the way that I see that in this adjoint functor formalism is that if I start with so what's x? X is the object k maps to k maps to 0 in under this identification, and y is the object 0 maps to k maps to k. And if you think, there's the morphism P is some corresponds to some morphism between here. But you know that if you write down f of x, so restriction to the boundary of x, if you calculate using all these things, you see that this is 0, k, 0, k. Right? So f basically takes this x and maps to this object and this object. And f of y gives you k shifted by minus 1, 0, k, 0. Right? And now you see that there's no maps between f of x and f of y. Right? So some maps between f of x and f of y would measure how like the Hom's coming from the boundary. But P does not come from the boundary. So we know that P, which is this Hom this is in the fiber of the map between x and y in the category fancy x to the maps between f of x and f of y. Right. And the problem with using P, remember, was that there was, because it existed, there had to be a map in the other direction with complementary degree. And in fact, this is going to show up in this case because the fiber of this map is going to be isomorphic to the dual of the mass between x and y and x, so going the other direction. Right. Okay, how much more time do I have? I think I'm... Okay, so what's the point of this example? Is to I'm trying to like move away from the picture and come up with some categorical description of this kind of stuff. It turns out the right way of saying this is using the notion of a relative Calabi-Yau structure. Right? So I just want to talk about that a little bit. Or a spherical functor. Right. Actually, in the interest of time, I'm not gonna talk about the relative Calabi-Yau structure. I'm just gonna go straight to the notion of a spherical functor. Right. So, definition. And this is by Ono and Logvinenko. Though the idea of spherical functors probably precedes that. Is that a functor? Well, we're here in the context of triangulated categories again, right? A functor between categories x and y, with both left and right adjoints, so star is going to be left adjoint to f, and shriek is going to be right adjoint to f. So this functor, you take these adjunctions, and you look at the unit map for there's a unit for f star, right? Which goes from identity in y. To f star, and you have f goes from identity x to so you have this canonical units for these adjunctions, and you now take the cofiber of this map of functors, right? So t is the cofiber of these functors. So the definition is that f is spherical if two things. First, this t is an autoequivalence. And then also if once you compose these units in a this way, so you get t from this map, and this is also a isomorphism of functors. Right, so you have this notion of spherical functors, and the inspiration for that was coming both from spherical twists and also from this notion of a like perverse sheaf of categories that you can define. Right, so the point here that a notion of spherical functor it seems like on the way to get to something like a relative Calabi-Yau structure, but it's not fully enough. Instead, you need some sort of compatibility with X and Y. So the definition is, and this is by Kotsarkov, Pandit, and Spade. Definition is that if Y is Calabi-Yau D, right? With some Calabi-Yau structure, Calabi-Yau D has Calabi-Yau structure D given by some phi, then this F spherical is compatible if you have a isomorphism between T and the serif functor shifted by minus D with some compatibility. With the Calabi-Yau structure. I'm not gonna write it down. So you have the structure. Does it ever appear? It's supposed to appear. It appears for like in algebraic geometry for some classes of divisors. But the case that it's closer to what I'm gonna think about is in the Foucault-Seidel category. So it also appears in this, well, conjecturally for these Foucault-Seidel categories. Right, but the point is that, and that's kind of the last thing I want to say, is that if you start with a sort of spherical functor and compatibility, right, and you just do said duality, so you start looking at x in y between y and x, so write it like this, take a dual. Just by said duality, this is the same as x between x and serif functor on y, given minus 1. And because you have this isomorphism with t, this is the same thing as maps in x from x to ty, which is divided by minus 1. But this was defined as the cofiber of this map. So you can also further use the adjunction. And in the end, this is the same thing as the fiber from x to y from fx, fy. Right, so this was that what appeared here. So the point is that if you you don't need to have a full Calabi-Yau structure if you have this compatible spherical structure, you already get the sort of identification that you want. So I guess fine. I'm gonna end with a sort of a conjecture. So there's the version of this non-crossing lemma. So the conjecture is that if you have x1 to y and x2 mapping to y, f1 and f2, and f1 and f2 are both compatible spherical, and you choose a stability condition on the fiber product, then this restricts to stability conditions on not necessarily x1, but x1 sort of extended by the envelope of y on one side and on the other side by this envelope of y extending x2, right? Anyways, that's all I want to say. Yeah. Sorry for coming all the way here. Yeah.
Is there any more algebraic version of this kind of GUI stability conditions?
Oh no, that's what I'm trying to get to. Yeah. Yeah. So, up to these lemmas about like non-crossing instead of being true or not. So what it looks like is that if you have a, I'm just going to draw this big diagram. If you have this sort of presentation of a category, right? So what do? We started with let me take adjoints and then express everything in terms of co-restriction. And your category was you sort of got it by taking some co-product. I took adjoints, so it's the same category as that one. Then you can draw a separate diagram where this embeds into its envelope, and this is like a. This is like the x2 tensor cross y with the envelope of y, and same thing as x1 on the side. And this closes into this cube, where this is an equivalence, right? Then the gluing statement is that for any stability condition you draw this, right? Then the stability condition here decomposes into stability conditions on these things, and the gluing is the converse, that if you have stability conditions here and here for some class of category in here, then you can glue them together and get something here. Yeah.
Like way back at the start, you have like the from stability conditions.
Yeah.
To
Yeah.
This is the isomorphism. There's like a non-emptiness assumption on stability conditions there, right?
It could be empty. Still, it's local on the space. Yeah, no, yeah, right.
Condition.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, fair enough.
So it's sort of. You have a stability condition. The amount of space you have to move around is exactly the group in the group, but.
Yeah. But first, you need to show that you can actually.
So yeah, you have to be very careful about how you state this theorem.
Yeah.
Right.
To get the correct statement. Because it's not, it's also kind of not exactly that it's a covering space.
It's not a covering space, it's not surjective, right? Oh, particularly it also like it doesn't hit zero, for example, right?
So if I was like, if the thing that I wanted to construct stability conditions on was like dv co of some variety.
Well, I mean, depends. What's the dimension of this thing?
I mean.
So yeah, stability conditions of variety. Like if you
like a globby R3 form or something.
Yeah, so we have one family of those on the quintic threefold.
Yeah.
Constructed a long time ago, but proven last year that it does give a stability condition.
Okay.
Yeah. It's hard.
Right, but yeah. So like is
it's very hard. So this category
is there a way to like try and use your thing to do.
Well, yeah, I don't know. We need to write it in some. So this works for this like Fukaya-Seidel categories. If it works, in the end, it will work for the Fukaya-Seidel categories.
Okay.
I don't know. Well, not all of them either, like some particular restricted class of them.
Yeah. How do you cut up a category of coherent sheaves, right?
Right, yeah.
Right, well, I mean, that would be one like that. Sure.
Yeah. So this, yeah, this Fukai-Seidel case, you have this sort of natural way of cutting parts of a category from each other.